Good morning. Thank you all for having me. It's an honor to be here. I noticed in your bulletin I was called the guest teacher, and I think some of my past church leaders would have a problem with that. But they're not here today, so that's okay. Up front, I'd like to say that I think of myself more as a storyteller rather than a public speaker, because much of what I have to say is through stories. And I think stories are one of the best ways that we as humans can connect and understand each other and learn from each other. And I'd also like to say that for me, sharing my story usually means people will come up to me afterwards and share parts of their stories. And I'm here if that's you and you'd like to talk about that. For me, this is a gift that you're able to be here and receive my story, and I'd be privileged to witness yours as well. Am I doing this wrong? I think I called the church leaders too much. They might be in the room with us. I'd really first like to share a little bit about geology and what a continental rift is. Hopefully not too boring. And then I'm going to share about my own story and how the reality of rifting caused me to reassess my life. And then lastly, I'm going to try to bring it back to how this kind of rifting, this loss, can lead us all to renewal and healing. But first, to set the scene, I'm going to read the epigraph that I put in the beginning of my book, which is a quote from Bernard Schlink in his novel called The Reader. And I like it because it connects those two things I'm trying to get at, the metaphor of geological change and the reality of human trauma. The tectonic layers of our lives rest so tightly one on top of the other that we always come up against earlier events and later ones, not as a matter that has been fully formed and pushed aside, but absolutely present and alive. I understand this. Nevertheless, I sometimes find it hard to bear. Maybe I did write our story to be free of it, even if I never can be. Now for the geology part. 1 billion years ago, the Great Lakes region was the site of a great breaking. The continent we now call North America was being pulled apart by tectonics. Massive plates of rock were moving in different directions, and magma was breaching the surface. The mid-continent rift reached from Oklahoma to Canada, though those names didn't exist back then. The land we stand on now was an unlivable, lava-filled hellscape. But then something happened. Geologists still don't understand exactly how, but the rifting of the land stopped. Typically, geological rifts result in continents splitting apart fully, but here, the rift was never completed. Instead, the land was left with a scar thousands of miles long. Skip forward more than 500 million years, and the region was covered in a tropical saltwater ocean. Though it's difficult to picture now, this ocean was the home of warm water corals and now extinct creatures. Up in northern Michigan, where I live, we find their fossilized remnants in Petoskey stones and Charlevoix stones. And after the Great Ocean, there was a Great Ice Age. Glaciers stretched down from the north and then receded, over and over, scraping out the earth, the already damaged rift, forming the basins of what we now know as the Great Lakes. What started as fire and destruction and a great breaking apart became this beautiful land that we are lucky enough to live on. Some of us swim in the freshwater lakes every summer. Some of us go rock hounding, bringing bits of this geologic history home with us. Some of us go fishing and boating and camping all across this wonderful region, spending time with the people we love without ever thinking about the rift that caused it all. But what does geology have to do with why I'm here today?
I'm not a geology expert, and I am definitely not a scientist. I actually had to have a geologist fact check my whole book, and I got lots wrong that I had to fix. But I do find a great deal to learn in the environments where we live, that we grow up in, and that we evolve in. And the environment that I grew up in had many labels: conservative, religious, fundamentalist, oppressive. I came of age in something called the Christian Patriarchy Movement. That is literally what we called it. It was a world loosely tied together by homeschooling conventions and church camps. It was a movement of many denominations: Presbyterian, Baptist, non-denominational. Our common ground was the belief that there were strict gender roles, quiverful ideology in which wives were expected to have as many children as possible, and dominionist theology teaching that our people would take over society and government for God's kingdom. Perhaps that all sounds familiar in the wake of Project 2025. From an early age, I was taught to think of myself as evil. My father would teach me and my siblings that we were dirty, rotten sinners, deserving hell. This teaching, combined with purity culture, led me to believe my body was part of the problem. And I started dissociating very young, feeling disembodied. I'd like to read a short passage from my book that describes one of those earliest memories. There's a photograph of me when I was around 4 years old, out at the summer cottage we used to rent on Star Lake in upstate New York. I'm wearing a pastel two-piece swimsuit. I have blunt bangs that curtain past my eyebrows, and I'm holding a fishing rod with a small fish dangling from the end. I'm squinting into the sun and smiling. I don't remember this moment, but I do remember the rough planks of the dock under my feet, the sun on the cold water of the lake, and that bathing suit. I also remember another moment, perhaps the following year, finding the swimsuit in my dresser and coming down to the lake, ready to swim or fish or jump in a canoe. "Tell her to go upstairs and change. She can't wear that," my father said. His hair was darker then, absent gray hairs. He wore the mustache and short shorts popular in the early 90s. I don't know if he was angry with me then, not in a loud way, not in the way he would be as I grew older and less compliant. I felt only his disappointment with me and with how I looked. My mother told me to change into the other swimsuit I had, a one-piece. "Go on, honey," she said softly, her oversized glasses and tight perm shielding her deep brown eyes. I didn't know what modesty meant then. I only knew I had done something wrong, that something must be wrong with the small band of skin showing at my middle. Most of all, I remember feeling ashamed. I remember trying to put the guilt into that swimsuit, as if it were evil somehow, as if it had tainted me, those flimsy pieces of stretchy fabric. Cover up. This was one of the first rules I learned. So this memory details the rift that was happening within myself. I learned long before I had the language for it that my very self, my body, was somehow wrong. And in order to conform to my father's expectations, I started to cut myself off from my inner voice just to survive. As I got older, my family became involved with an organization called Vision Forum, based out of Texas. It was a ministry and a business that sold this idea of the ideal godly family. We got their shiny catalogs in the mail, selling toys for children. There were slingshots for boys, teacups for girls. And then one year, my father went to a conference in San Antonio and brought home a new teaching, the idea of the stay-at-home daughter. A stay-at-home daughter is a girl who doesn't leave home when she turns 18. She doesn't go to college. She doesn't date. She doesn't work unless it is something her father can supervise, like babysitting or teaching piano. Her job is to be a secondary helpmeet to her father, learning how to run a household and preparing to be a wife whenever her father finds her a husband through the courtship process. This was taught to us as God's plan, using examples from the Old Testament, such as Abraham and Isaac. As a young girl, I understood these things very clearly. I would not be in control of my future. God wanted me to obey my father no matter what, and my happiness did not factor into the equation because sacrifice and submission were more important. My job was to wait at home until my husband came along and led me to the rest of my life, which would likely be childbirth and homeschooling a 14-passenger van of children. But as I mentioned earlier, I was already very skilled in the art of dissociation. I could numb out easily and rarely felt pain. Even when I started experiencing the symptoms of a chronic illness I wouldn't be diagnosed with until decades later. I read books to escape, and I took long walks in the woods alone, the one place I felt alive. This is how many years passed, and I was a stay-at-home daughter until I was 25 years old. I was very submissive, trusting that my father knew what was best and that God would reward me for obeying him. What I didn't have language for at the time was the emotional, spiritual, physical, and financial abuse I experienced at the hands of my father. When I was 20 years old, I had a courtship with a man from church, but after about 8 months, my father decided he wasn't my future husband and ended the relationship. I was devastated. I had spent so much time with this man thinking that I would marry him. But when I expressed my brokenheartedness to my father, I'll never forget what he said to me. He told me I was sinning with my emotions because I wasn't supposed to love someone that I wasn't married to, that I was cheating on my future husband, and that I needed to repent. I remember feeling like I was floating to the ceiling and watching myself crumble below. But I also knew deep down that my father was wrong. How could it be sinful to love someone? How could it be wrong to feel affection and sadness? I couldn't help how I felt. How could God want to send me to hell for something I couldn't change? I told myself I would never let my father ruin another relationship for me again. I didn't know how I would ever leave with the limited resources I had, but I did know that I would make a better choice for myself when I had the opportunity. And this was the beginning of a big rift in my life. The lava hadn't broken through yet, but I could feel it getting hot. For a few years after that, I lived in perpetual cognitive dissonance. If my father loved me, why did it feel like he was hurting me? If God wanted me to obey my parents, why was it becoming so difficult? If God was love, why was I in so much pain when I was doing everything I could to please him? And when I was 24, I did something that made my father start calling me a rebellious feminist. I fell in love with the pastor's son and took my romantic life into my own hands. My father forbade our relationship, but I decided to keep seeing him anyway. And when we decided the only way out of my difficult situation was for us to get married, and we told my parents I was leaving, all the dysfunction in my family hit the fan. I believed I was making the best choice for me. But at the same time, I felt like I was breaking apart my family. And when I moved away to get married, I felt like I'd lost them, not to mention the community of other Quiverful families that had been my whole world. A few years later, after I started telling my story publicly, my father made the rift more permanent, and I went no contact with him. The year after that, I stopped going to church altogether, and I lost my last religious community. And last year, I got divorced, which was another great loss. Every rift was extremely painful, and I didn't know how it would get better, but I knew I had to move forward, trusting that I was doing the right thing. Each of these experiences of grief became moments for me to seriously examine what I believe and decide how I wanted to show up in the world. Leaving a cult-like movement is the ultimate fresh start, and it really makes you examine where you've come from and what you want to do with your life. And losing relationships makes you think about who you want with you and why. So the losses gave me room to reassess everything. And that change led to me going to trauma therapy for my PTSD, which meant I could tell my story without shaking. I was able to go to college and study writing, which led to my memoir. And being public with my story has led to me meeting many others who have experienced similar things. When I think of my story now, I don't think of it as a story of loss, but of expansion. I was able to grow and become more of myself. I made new friends and built a new community. I followed my passion, and it led me here today. My world has expanded to include love and purpose beyond what I could have imagined as a stay-at-home daughter. Sometimes people tell me my experience was unique, but what I have found is at the core of these things, no matter our background, we share many similarities. We will all experience loss in our lives. We all grieve, and there's no avoiding it. I've been reading a book called Wintering by Catherine May, and I started it thinking that it would be about how to rest in the winter and make your home cozy and enjoy the darkest days of the year. And it's kind of about that. But what is at the core of the book, I think, is dealing with the winter of grief. May writes, "Wintering brings about some of the most profound and insightful moments of our human experience, and wisdom resides in those who have wintered." I think what she's saying here is that grief truly is revelatory. We can't help but learn more about ourselves and our worlds when we experience loss. Our focus becomes so sharpened in those moments that we see things in a new way. But that doesn't make it easy. The double edge of loss is that it threatens to destroy us. So how do we cope with that? How do we handle loss when it comes for us? How do we heal when there are such gaping wounds in our souls? I wish I had easy answers, but in trauma therapy, you learn about having different tools in your toolbox to cope with past trauma and with present stress in healthy ways. And I'd like to share a few of my favorite tools with you. The first tool is acceptance. We can recognize the glaring gaps of grief in our lives instead of trying to hide from them. We let ourselves feel all the emotions that arise: anger, sadness, frustration, loneliness, trying to sit with the discomfort instead of dissociating. And when we do that, we also make room for growth. We might get to acceptance through journaling or support group or cognitive behavioral therapy. The second tool is compassion, both for ourselves and for others. When I left my family and eventually the church, I had to come to terms with how I had been complicit in patriarchal systems and communities that caused harm. I had caused harm. I had to process that, grieve that, and then work to do better. But in order to do better, I also had to work on having compassion and grace for myself and extending that compassion to others. This isn't to excuse bad behavior, but it is having an open-hearted attitude about who we are and what we could be. The third tool is grounding ourselves in a larger perspective. I try to show this in my book by alternating between stories of my childhood and reflections on geology. The stories of abuse can be difficult to take in, even for me as I was writing them. But writing about nature and our planet and how the universe has one very long story of transformation gave me perspective and comfort. Sometimes we get stuck inside our own heads because we have this negativity bias, and we ruminate about things we can't control. But understanding we are just one part of a greater whole can help us cope with that feeling of helplessness. Writing, for me, helps me stay grounded. But for you, maybe that's meditation or taking a walk outside. And the last tool I'll leave you with is embodiment. Even in our pain, we can inhabit the bodies we have and live in our present moment. We all have different physical abilities, so this tool may look different for each of us. Maybe embodiment means dancing or yoga or hugging each other. Maybe it's a breathing exercise or somatic therapy. Whatever it is, we need this connection with ourselves and with other people in order to ever dream of healing after loss. No matter what oppression we're facing, what grief we're experiencing, as long as we're alive, no one can take our sense of self and our experience of living from us. In connecting with ourselves ensures we hold on to our humanity and can see the humanity in others, which is perhaps the most subversive thing you can do in a time of social upheaval. When I think of these tools, an image I find helpful is of a tree with a root system. If you only use one tool or resource, you will struggle to find healing. A tree with one root will fall over at the first strong wind. But if you have multiple roots of support, you will be able to stand tall and keep growing. So a rift is not just loss, it's transformation, it's clarification. When we experience it, it's gut-wrenching, but when we move through it, it's life-changing. So I'll leave you with the ending of my book because it represents perhaps the deepest truth I believe in now. If there is any meaning here, it is that change is everything. The land underneath me is in constant flux, if only I could see it with the eyes of the universe. And I am also in flux in the moments I am standing here, my face to the sky. I cannot stop the change. In the rifting of my life, I learned who I really am. As humans, we hold on to memories even when we try to forget, and our experiences reside in the molecules of our bodies. But we can survive, and in that separating, we become something new, always evolving. I have lost a lot, but I have gained autonomy and found my own voice. I have found community through writing, love through connection, letting go of beliefs that poisoned me, of relationships that harmed me. I thought this would leave me empty. My life had been so full of grief, and now I have room to love and be loved, to explore the earth unafraid, to pray or be silent. I am open to the wonder of living. I lie down on my back on the ground, close my eyes, breathe slowly. Feel the pulse of the universe, the shifting of the earth beneath me. I am so small, almost nothing in this grand cosmos. Yet I'm here. I'm part of it. Instead of splitting a continent, the great rift healed at the seam, scarred over, two sides still connected, bridged with water. Thank you.